Hello, welcome to On Science, the weekly podcast from NPR Science Desk. I'm Christopher Joyce.
And I'm Joe Palca. This week we'll be talking about prime numbers and the latest in the let's make a lot of money off of the carbon problem the world's facing.
And a story about making a more environmentally friendly battery.
And we'll hear from Robert Krulwich on how language shapes our thinking, whether we think it does or not.
But first, let's start with primes.
Right, and that's me. So it turns out about 13 years ago, I did a story about these strange things called Mersenne primes. And they're a funny kind of prime number, which I'll tell you about in the piece. But
Spell Mersenne for me, would you?
It's capital M-E-R-S-E-N-N-E.
And later on, we'll find out what that means, right?
You'll find out who that is. Okay, so it turns out that in order to search for these numbers, there's this project going on where computers that are operating, you know, these programs that run in the background, maybe you heard about that one, SETI, the search for extraterrestrial.
Yeah.
So they had
SETI. Did they find anything, by the way?
Well, they have these programs where people analyze parts of the SETI data on their laptops or desktops when they're on. It sort of runs in the background. So this is a program that runs in the background that searches for prime numbers. And first, you need a. I know you need a quick reminder, Chris. A prime number is a number that's divisible only by one and itself. So 2 is prime, 3 is prime, 5 is prime, 7 prime.
And
right now,
there's only one prime number that's an even number.
2.
You got it.
That was pretty quick. Now, it turns out that the largest prime found to date is 13 million digits, or to be 100% precise, it's 12,978,189 digits. And if you want an idea of how big that is, well, let's say you wanted to write it on a piece of paper, and you write about 10 digits per inch. So that's 12,978,189 divided by 10 digits per inch divided by 12 inches per foot divided by 5,280 feet per mile. And the answer is 20.48 miles. Now that's a long number. It was discovered last summer as part of something called GIMPS.
GIMP is the Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search.
That's George Woltman, the man behind the Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search. He's a software engineer in Florida. Mersennes are a special kind of prime. They're named for a 17th century French theologian who made some predictions about them that actually turned out to be wrong. If you want to see the mathematical formula that describes Mersenne primes, it's on our website. Turns out Mersenne primes are the easiest to find, and Woltman has written a free, downloadable program to search for them.
It takes about 2 or 3 weeks to test a single number, and everybody's plugging away trying to find yet another prime number.
They've been doing it for 13 years and found 10 so far.
The main obstacle in proving these numbers prime is just doing the arithmetic with numbers that size.
Chris Caldwell is a mathematician at the University of Tennessee at Martin. Caldwell says there's a formula to test if a large number is a Mersenne prime, but it's computationally intense.
Not only do you have to multiply a 13-million-digit number times a 13-million-digit number, you have to do that about 13 million times. And then that just takes a tremendous amount of computation.
So what's the big deal here? Why are some people so anxious to find the next largest Mersenne prime? I've asked several people, and the response is generally the same. Because.
Well, actually, that's really not a bad answer.
I wasn't about to let him off the hook that easily, so he expanded a bit.
Mersennes, in a way, are kind of like a large diamond. When I go to Washington, I took my kids to see the Hope Diamond.
The 45-carat diamond sits in a special case in the National Museum of Natural History, usually with crowds around it.
Nobody there looking at the Hope Diamond ever asks, you know, why did somebody bother to dig it up or what is it good for? You know, even though it really isn't good for much other than to just hang there and people to look at. And in many ways, the Mersennes play that same role, that they really are the jewels of number theory.
No one can say for sure when the next Mersenne prime will be discovered. But I told Chris Caldwell I'd made a little bet with George Woltman, the man who wrote the program that searches for Mersenne primes. Woltman bet the next one wouldn't be found until the second quarter of 2012. So if it's the first quarter or sooner, I win, and if it's the second quarter or later, he wins.
Let me think.
You thinking?
Yeah, I'm thinking. I think I'm going to go with George.
Big mistake, because I intend to win this bet. If all the people listening to this story and their friends and relations download Woltman's program, that means the search for the next largest prime will be faster. Don't worry, Woltman assures me the program doesn't interfere with anything. It runs when a computer isn't doing something more important. There's no financial glory here, no money riding on this bet, just the joy of victory for me and the chance for someone to enter the Mersenne Prime Hall of Fame. It could be you. You can find a link to the searching software at our website, npr.org.
Joe, that's cheating.
Yes, totally.
Reminds me of the guy who said he could hit a golf ball a mile, and so he took the golf ball out to the edge of a frozen lake and won $10,000.
Not bad. Well, and actually, I want to tell you one other thing. I was trying to get this guy on the phone for the podcast, but I wasn't able to reach him in time. So I was trying to think of a way of telling some people how big this number was, you know, and I was thinking about, okay, if you type it on your computer, well, oh, my goodness, I walked into the world of typography because typesetting is like a huge art form. And I found out that there are fonts that are fixed width and fonts that are variable width. But I talked to a guy who made a fixed width font, but then he asked me, what about kerning? Oh, what's kerning? Well, kerning turns out you can take little spaces out between the letters. So he said, well, let me look at this number. I said, it's 12 million, you know, 13 million digits long. She says, okay, I got software that'll handle that. So he downloads the 13 million letter digit number into his computer software, and he switches on kerning, which means that it takes a little space out when there's a 7 and a 4 together. And he says, oh, well, if it's 108,000 feet normally, if you turn kerning on, you save 1,000 feet.
And a lot of paper.
And hey. A lot of paper. So, you know, if somebody decides to do this, be sure to turn kerning on. You'll save 1,000 feet.
Well, speaking of saving paper, we're going to talk a bit about saving carbon. And we're going to talk about the carbon market, which is sort of a mysterious thing that's been going on for a few years. But we have an expert from the carbon market with us in the NPR Prod Room 1 here. It's Amy Barnes from a company called EcoSecurities, who's in town for something called Carbon Trade Expo, if I've got that right.
That's
welcome,
correct.
Amy.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Thanks for coming. I need to ask you if you can fill the uninitiated in on what the carbon market is all about and what your company, EcoSecurities, does within that market.
So basically, people have probably heard of something called cap and trade, whereby a limit is set on the total amount of greenhouse gases that can be emitted into the atmosphere. And then different companies are given different amounts of credits for those greenhouse gases, which then they can trade amongst themselves to reach most efficiently the desired level of reductions that needs to be undertaken as established by scientists to prevent dangerous climate change. One component of the cap and trade market internationally has been something called an offset program. And basically, offsets represent emission reductions, real emission reductions that take place outside the cap. So from things like forests, programs at farms.
Capturing methane. That
capturing
sort of thing,
methane from landfills, exactly. And those offsets can then be traded as credits into the cap and trade system to contain the costs of the overall program.
I see. So I, if, for example, I'm an entrepreneur, a carbon cowboy.
And, or cowgirl.
And I go out to some place like Mexico and I find a way to reduce carbon from a pig farm. And then I pay them to do this and I get the credits, right?
That's correct.
These offset credits. And then I can, what do I do with them?
At present, you can sell them into something called the Kyoto system through the Clean Development Mechanism, which is a UN policy that was established as part of the Kyoto Protocol, this big international climate change agreement. And you can sell them to a company that would need them to meet their emission reduction targets.
So this is what the market is all about. So your company, EcoSecurities, tell me what they do.
EcoSecurities is one of the largest developers of projects under the Clean Development Mechanism. We've been around for about 10 years. And so we have offices in about 18 countries with people going out, just as you said, talking to landfill owners, farmers, owners of industrial facilities in various developing countries, helping them understand how their facility can make an emission reduction and how they can make money off of that.
So I've heard that this business, I mean, it's a fairly new business, and I've heard it's been growing. I think something like $100, $120 billion was traded in carbon offsets and carbon allowances.
That's right.
But it's also been born during a time when, you know, the ship has hit the sand, so to speak, in the recession worldwide. How has that affected the carbon market? Has it slowed the promise that people thought it had?
I think in one sense, yes. Certainly there's been sort of a constriction in the past 6 months of capital that's available to be put into these projects. And so it's increasingly difficult to fund good projects. But at the same time, I think it makes more of a case for the need for offset projects, because particularly as we move forward in developing a cap-and-trade system in the U.S., we're going to want to do that in the most economically efficient way possible so that people's pocketbooks are hit as little as possible. And to the extent that offsets provide cost containment in that system, it's an important component moving forward.
But, you know, the U.S. doesn't have a cap-and-trade system yet, and it's, you know, it's subject to a heck of a lot of debate and speculation. We've got some sort of blueprint now from Henry Waxman in Congress. But, you know, there's the market already exists. I mean, the Waxman proposal, is it going to hurt people in the business now or help them, or are some people going to profit from this and some people not?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of proposals that have come out, and Waxman is a good first indication of where we'll be, but it's certainly not, I think, where we will end up. But, you know, I think the bill as it's written certainly has a role for companies like EcoSecurities to continue our current business model, and it creates a lot of opportunities for brand new businesses to come out and start profiting from this need to reduce greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I hear from some people over at the Trade Expo where I was wandering around yesterday, you know, times are hard and the money that was expected to flow into the market may not be what it was before. And, you know, with the Waxman bill, it seems as if there is some future cap-and-trade system which would stimulate a market, but nobody knows exactly what it's going to look like. But then there's the business going on in Europe right now about what happens after Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012. And, you know, some people even say there might not be another treaty after Kyoto. And what does that do for people in the carbon market? I mean, it would seem that people in markets need sort of reliability, and they're not getting it.
And I think that gets back to your previous point. I think perhaps even more than the lack of capital in the markets, one thing that's really reducing the flow of new projects into the existing pipeline is this looming uncertainty about what will happen with the Kyoto Protocol post-2012. Will there even be this clean development mechanism that EcoSecurities has based its business model on after 2012? And how will the sequencing of the decisions that are being made here in the United States about a federal program, how will that sort of sync up with and potentially impact or interact with the international negotiations? People love to speculate about how all of this will pan out. And to a certain extent, it's sort of my job to speculate about this for our company.
And for us.
And for you. But truth be told, I think there are a lot of X factors out there right now that nobody can anticipate. And so as it all unfolds, certainly all of us who are attending TradeX this week will be watching it closely to make sure that we are adjusting our business model to meet the development and rollout of policies moving forward.
Enough to start rewriting your resume?
Not yet.
I mean, are you worried about the future of the carbon market, or is there going to be one in some way, shape, or form always?
I think that carbon markets are here to stay, and I think in particular my focus within the company is on U.S. regulatory affairs, and I think, interestingly, the carbon market is an example of an industry because it's predicated almost entirely on policy decisions where people who understand policy will have a role to play in addition to the people who are going out developing projects, financing projects, and selling the credits.
So what would you say to somebody who's coming out of, say, business school, who's looking for a future in the market world, and they come up and say, you know, carbon market sounds really cool, I can save the planet and make some money. What would you advise them?
It's a very sexy industry to get into right now, and there's certainly a lot of interest, both from recent grads and from people looking to make a career switch. I'd say that the pool of people interested in the market is growing exponentially, and so the competition is growing as well. I think it requires sort of an interesting mix of interest in environmental issues, knowledge of finance, knowledge of environmental science, climate change. So be prepared for leveraging all different types of skills, and I would say be prepared for a little bit of frustration because it's still a very young market and there's a lot to be worked out as we move forward.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of, what was the Dustin Hoffman movie, The Graduate, where the guy leaned over and said to him, the future is plastic. So is the future carbon now?
I think there's certainly a case to be made that carbon is going to become a very integral consideration to business. And I think if it's done right, we'll open the door moving forward for the possibility of monetizing and giving a value to other ecosystem services like biodiversity, like water, that have not been given a financial value in the past, but that are important to us. And I think that's sort of the next frontier of markets in a very interesting and exciting way.
Well, thanks for coming in. This is really interesting, and you made it totally understandable, at least for me, and I think for our listeners as well.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Okay, let's talk about batteries and about genetic engineering, which has revolutionized the field of medicine. It may be about to revolutionize the field of energy. Researchers at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, have used a genetically engineered virus to make a lithium battery. The new approach holds the promise not only of more powerful batteries, but also batteries that are more environmentally friendly to make. Here's Joe Packer's story.
Many scientists believe that to crack a tough problem, you need to bring a variety of different disciplines to bear on it. Angela Belcher is a one-woman multidisciplinary team. She's trained in biology, solid-state inorganic chemistry, and electrical engineering. Now she's a professor at MIT in biological and material engineering, and she has a mission.
The main things that I'm really interested in are using natural biological processes to make technologically important materials.
Because biological systems can build things efficiently and, well, naturally. A few years ago, Belcher began working on batteries. She wanted to find a material for a battery electrode that would have the right electrical properties and could be assembled by a biological system.
We chose iron phosphate because lithium iron phosphate was already shown to be a good battery material, and also because biology has done a fantastic job with those elements.
What she means is iron and phosphate are used by lots of biological systems. There's iron in red blood cells, and phosphate is an important ingredient in DNA. Belcher needed to find a scaffolding of iron and phosphate that would form the basis of a battery electrode. The biological system she chose to do this was a virus. Belcher says viruses come in two basic shapes, spherical and long and skinny.
This is a long and skinny virus. We like it because its shape is already like a wire.
The viruses attracted iron and phosphate molecules along their length. This made a stiff scaffolding. She then made a version of the virus that held tight to carbon nanotubes. This allowed electricity to flow in and out of the battery. The cool thing about her research is that if Belcher didn't like the properties of her electrode, she could use the techniques of molecular biology to tweak the DNA of the virus that was making it. She was, in a sense, evolving her virus, which was evolving her electrode, so that she could select the one that worked the best. Put enough of these nano-electrodes together, and you can create a kind of bio-battery that can power an LED light. You can see it on our website.
It's fun and it's kind of cute to power a green LED, but what about my laptop? What about my iPhone? What about my car? And the power performance is there for us. Now it's a matter of scale.
Achieving that scale should be doable. David Wright is a chemist at Vanderbilt University in Nashville.
It would be a different manufacturing process, but I think that there's a very reasonable chance that the whole procedure would scale industrially.
Wright says the new battery electrode already has properties that put it on a par with batteries being manufactured commercially today.
But this battery is made in water, has no organic solvents in it, and the material is made at room temperature.
So in theory, manufacturing this bio-battery will take less energy and produce fewer pollutants. Paul King of the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, is also impressed.
We all know how important renewable energy is in developing more efficient alternative energy systems, and this is certainly one
using genetically engineered viruses to make batteries. Who'd have thought? The new work appears in the journal Science.
That was interesting, Joe, but I need to clear up one thing. This doesn't remove the need for lithium in batteries,
no,
does it?
No, the lithium is still part of what's called the electrolyte, which is the internal goo of the battery. And these electrodes are presumably more efficient, so you might need less lithium, but no, you still need
more. Yeah, I was wondering, because people in the battery business say there's not a lot of lithium around, and that could be what the showstopper with hybrid cars is, that if we don't have enough lithium in the ground to use in the cars, we're in trouble.
Could be. So anyway, on to language, and this is the final piece on this podcast. Robert Krulwich just did a remarkable little story about how scientists who study language study how it shapes the way we think.
I love the way he gets from the science to Shakespeare. And hang in there. It's a really great story.
Okay. Now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to ask a German speaker.
Guten Tag.
And a Spanish speaker.
Saludos, damas y caballeros.
We're going to show each of you some simple nouns, words on a screen, like table, chair, maybe a bridge. If you speak German, what is the word for bridge?
Die Brücke.
Die Brücke, which is what kind of a noun?
It's a feminine noun.
Okay, so we all know that in many languages, nouns can be either masculine, feminine. In German, again, it's...
Die Brücke.
And in Spanish, the word for bridge is...
El Puente.
Which is... Which kind, a masculine or a feminine?
Masculine, El is always masculine.
Okay, so the Spanish speakers call bridges by a masculine noun. With German speakers, it is...
Feminine noun.
Okay, now comes the fun part. At her lab, assistant psychology professor Lyra Boroditsky of Stanford University asked a bunch of Spanish speakers, and then German speakers, to look at simple words on a screen, including, as it happens, the word bridge.
And for each object, we just asked them, give us three adjectives that describe that object.
Just look at the picture and say whatever comes into your head.
What we find is that Spanish and German speakers come up with a very different set of descriptions for things like a bridge.
For German speakers, where the bridge is feminine, the adjectives that popped up most for them were...
Beautiful, extended, elegant.
And also fragile and pretty. But for Spanish speakers, when they looked at a bridge, they chose...
Long, strong, thrilling.
Towering, sturdy, dangerous. So, when your word for bridge is a masculine noun...
People start to focus on the more masculine parts.
What Lyra Boroditsky found is that the grammar that you learned from your parents, whether you know it or not, affects your sensual experience of the world. If you're German, you can look at the same bridge as a Spaniard, and because of a grammatical difference between masculine and feminine nouns...
You find, wow, their underlying understandings of these things are totally different.
And it's not just bridges. Germans and Spaniards have different genders for tables and for chairs, for all kinds of nouns.
That's a whole lot of stuff.
It is. So when you inherit a language...
You're inheriting much more than just how to speak. You're learning a whole cultural system.
Here's another example. Lyra asked some German speakers to look at a toaster.
Der Toaster.
That's the German word?
Masculine.
Okay.
Der.
So everybody turned on their computers, and alongside the picture of the toaster were some suggested names, including the name Patricia.
And we had one German speaker come out in the middle of the experiment, and she said, I just wanted to tell you, I think there's something wrong with your computer. I think it's broken. We said, why do you say that? And she said, well, it just told me the toaster's name is Patricia, and I know that can't be true because toasters are male.
So it was somehow deeply ingrained in her that toasters have this quality.
Yes, and that is how it feels intuitively, you know, as a Russian speaker. I grew up in Russia, and then my parents and I moved to America, and I had to, of course, learn English.
And as Lyra became more and more of an English speaker...
I felt like I was thinking in an entirely different way.
And Lyra couldn't help but wonder, is this just the rules of grammar, masculine and feminine nouns, that are creating these differences, or could it be something else?
You know... Something in the olive oil that Spanish speakers eat, or, you know, it could be anything. There's so many differences between German speakers and Spanish speakers. So one way to establish whether it's really language that plays this role is to bring people into the lab and teach them a new language.
So she invented one.
We have a language called Gumbuzi.
Gumbuzi. And what does Gumbuzi sound like?
I don't know. You tell me.
Useful phrases in Gumbuzi.
Part 23, crossing the bridge.
Corbat, ti scalfa parto u bridge.
Excuse me, I left my umbrella on your bridge.
Now you try.
I see you're very familiar with Gumbuzi. Nearly fluent.
To be fair, I just invented that version of Gambuzi. How could I not? But back to Lyra's version. What she did was she got a bunch of American students who speak only English. So for them, tables and chairs have no gender. They'd had no experience with masculine or feminine nouns. And for a day, she taught these kids a language that assigned gender arbitrarily to different nouns. So she told them half the nouns will begin with U.
Use big truck.
Big truck.
Use chest hair.
Chest hair.
Use man.
A man.
The other half of the things are supative.
Meaning they begin with su.
Su pink.
Pink.
Su soft.
Soft.
Su woman.
Woman.
And she assigned us and sus to tables and chairs arbitrarily. And after one day learning this new language,
what we find is that just learning this kind of grammatical distinction in the lab is enough to induce some of the very same effects.
So if the word bridge, for example, in Gambuzi is a male word, ou bridge, will they begin assigning it dangerous, long, towering, strong, and sturdy?
That's exactly what we see.
And that just comes from the inner logic of the grammar of the language?
And And you have no idea it's happening to you. You just think you're learning a way of talking, but really you're learning a whole way of seeing the world.
But you know, I keep listening to you and I'm thinking about Shakespeare.
What do you mean?
Well, if we went back to the fundamental question here, remember it was Shakespeare who said that what we call a thing does not matter, like with the rose thing? A rose.
That's right. Shakespeare had a hypothesis that a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. Yeah. And actually, I've had students in a class of mine at MIT test out Shakespeare's hypothesis.
What do they do?
You make two paper bags, and you put a rose in each.
And then, I guess, with a magic marker, what you do is you mark one of the bags rose, and the other bag, though it also has roses inside, you label mowed grass or something like that. And then you invite people to sniff each bag. They can't look. They just sniff.
And then they have to rate how pleasant the smell is, how sweet the smell is, and so on.
And it turns out that a rose by another name, mowed grass, does not smell as sweet. People overwhelmingly said the bag mark rose smelled to them sweeter. So Shakespeare was wrong.
You can turn Shakespeare into an experiment.
And these experiments suggest not only that the language you speak seems to change your experience of the world, it may even change, I don't know, the way you think?
Yeah, the way you think, the way you see the world, the way you live your life. All of those things.
Lyra Boroditsky teaches psychology at Stanford University in California. I'm Robert Krulwich, NPR News in New York.
I've always thought that the language that you speak does indeed pretty much determine kind of your worldview, you know, this business of the feminine nouns and masculine nouns. It sounds strange to people who speak English, but if you've studied a Romance language, you know, you get used to that idea, and it certainly worked for me.
So how do you explain that Agricola, which is Latin for farmer, has a feminine ending, but usually is a masculine noun?
Listen, in Spanish, there's a lot of weird words that are feminine and masculine that just don't seem to work. But, well, you know, it's
okay, well,
their worldview.
The nice thing is you can study this for a long time.
And we can go on talking and making radio programs about it, too.
Probably so. Well, anyway, that's it for this week's podcast. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week. I'm Joe Palca.
I'm Christopher Joyce.